cooler through the weekend. In fact, the expanded forecast for Friday through Sunday, dry and cold. Friday's high 29, Saturday's high 27, Sunday's high 33. Right now, winds out of the west at 35 miles an hour, gusting as high as 47 miles per hour over the last hour. We have a temperature reading of 40 with bright blue sunshine. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is coming up. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTDHD. I'm Gregory Berg. Three interviews for you today. Part one with the man who is the first blind man to scale the summit of Mount Everest. Part two is a preview of an exciting orchestra concert coming up Sunday afternoon at Carthage College. Part three, some thoughts about Lyme disease. Stay with us. I am very excited to be speaking with a real-life hero today on The Morning Show. His name is Eric Weihenmayer, and I'm sure many of you know his name, and with good reason. Eric Weihenmayer has been to the summit of Mount Everest, and it so happens that he is the first and still only blind person to ever reach that summit. Not only that, he has climbed the highest peaks of all seven continents. He has led a group of blind young Tibetans 21,000 feet up the face of Mount Everest and accomplished a whole lot of other things. In fact, some people would say teaching middle school for 6 years was probably an accomplishment roughly akin to scaling Mount Everest. His most recent adventure involved kayaking the entire 277 miles of the Grand Canyon on the Colorado River. Dangerous for anybody. And it is an accomplishment made, in a sense, at great cost and at great peril. And the story is told in a really great book called No Barriers, A Blind Man's Journey to Kayak the Grand Canyon. And No Barriers, the title of the book, also refers to an exciting program which Eric Weihenmayer helped create, which helps to create exciting and life-transforming opportunities for people who are contending with various challenges and limitations of one kind or another. The book, again, No Barriers, is published by Thomas Dunn. And Eric Weihenmayer, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you very much.
I'm really excited to talk with you. I should mention your previous books are Touch the Top of the World and The Adversity Advantage. You spend a fair amount of this book, and I'm glad you do, sort of setting the stage, in part by talking about your own blindness. Explain briefly to our listeners when it was that you went entirely blind and what that experience was like, particularly in the moment.
Yeah, I write about, it was like winning the lottery, but the opposite. So I had this missing some genes. So nobody in my family had ever been blind or anything, but I was born visually impaired. I could see a little bit until middle school when I started losing a lot of sight. And a week before my freshman year in high school, I was totally blind. I remember being led into school that first day and thinking, I can't literally see to take a step.
Right. If I can just jump in, you tell a really cool story about watching an inspiring story on television in those last days before your blindness became complete. Tell us about the real life figure you watched on television, and the kind of inspiration that he was for you in that difficult moment.
So I was in a dark place. I could still see a little bit out of one eye just for a couple more months. So I'd watch TV with my nose right up against the screen, and I watched this guy named Terry Fox. He was a phenomenon. I mean, he was a Canadian. He lost a leg to cancer. And then he made this decision, which was like the craziest decision. He decided he was going to run across Canada, thousands of miles. And I thought, you're not supposed to react that way. You know, that's, you're supposed to shrink. You're supposed to kind of curl up in a ball and just protect the little bit you have left. You know, that's what happens when, you know, that when tragedy strikes. But he didn't know that. He got bigger and he converted that darkness into something else, and he used it as energy, and he used it to propel himself forward. And you know, Terry Fox is a hero of mine and a huge Canadian legend, and it was all based on one decision, and that really set up the message of the book and my exploration over the last 16 years trying to understand what no barriers means, like these counterintuitive ways that people react to these situations. They get shattered, and instead of getting smaller, they get bigger. And it's a part of that map that I think is important.
Absolutely. Back to the first days of your blindness, just for a moment. One of the most poignant things you describe in that, as you began school as a ninth grader, newly blind, completely blind, that is, although, as you said, you'd contended with vision limitations all of your life, but you describe, if I remember correctly, sitting in the cafeteria of that school and hearing kind of all the chaos and fun all around you, including a food fight erupting at one point. And of course, you are not a part of any of this. And just the thought that you'll never be in a food fight, in a sense, was a moment in which the reality of this began to really sink in. And I just think that's so interesting how, for particularly a young person of that age, it would be something like that that would make you feel the most like you were on the outside looking in, so to speak.
Oh, yeah. I mean, so sitting in that cafeteria seat by myself at my own table, all my friends were a couple tables away in the middle of that food fight, laughing and joking. And I remember thinking, like, yeah, it's scary to go blind, not be able to see, but the real fear was being swept to the sidelines and listening to your life go by and feeling these sort of prison bars, you know, fall down around your mind and not knowing how to get out of that and how to break through that brick wall between, right, you know, get me back to the world. And
even if it's an ordinary life, I think that's why that leapt out at me in your book, because, you know, your book is mostly about scaling Mount Everest and then riding the rapids of the Colorado River. In this painful moment, you're not thinking about any of that. You just want to be able to access something as normal as a food fight in your high school's gymnasium or cafeteria. One of the things you do to try to sort of forge a path towards a normal full life is that you join your school's wrestling team. And this ends up being a really important part of your life. Just explain how successful you ultimately were able to be after some struggles in the early going.
Yeah, I stunk my first few years, but I got better. And it was the greatest decision I could have made, because it was my first experience being a part of something great, you know. And I think people crave to be part of things, you know, especially when you're blind and you have some challenge and you feel isolated. So, yeah, I worked my way up to captain and represented our state and nationals. And, yeah, I turned out to be a good wrestler, but it was a lot of work, and it was a hard road.
Right. And I should think that being blind and wrestling, I mean, you were operating with a really acute disadvantage and probably had to bring all of your other skills up to the highest possible level in order to be a worthy competitor, which you turned out to be.
Yeah, it's not that much different from climbing, really, because, you know, I'm making predictions. I can't see the person's leg, but I feel their, like, wrist, and that gives me a clue where their leg might be, you know, by their body position. And climbing's the same way. You know, you can't see the rock, but you are feeling up the rock using your hands and your feet as your eyes, and you're sort of making predictions about where that next hold might be in the rock. And so, yeah, when you're blind, you're doing a lot of sort of mapping in your brain.
Well, ultimately, you are able to go on from those successes to completing college and to getting a job teaching middle school. And, of course, that was no small matter either, in that there are all kinds of principals and superintendents who are not willing to give a blind teacher a chance in a sighted environment, in a classroom of sighted students. But someone took a chance, and you ended up being a very successful and happy teacher. What was it that prompted you to leave that kind of adventure for the kind of adventures that have dominated your life since, including the scaling of Mount Everest? What sort of hunger prompted that dramatic move?
Well, I was a teacher for 6 years, and I loved it. I could have done it forever. I loved that part of my life. And I'd been climbing, though. I'd been a what you call a weekend warrior, which is like you're climbing hard on the weekends. And I started climbing bigger mountains, and I realized I couldn't do both. I couldn't teach. I wanted to make a life in the mountains. And so in 1997, I left teaching, and I tried to make my life as a blind adventurer, which there's not too many countries in the world where you can become a professional blind climber. It's not too many venture capitalist funds would have invested in that idea. But the last 20 years, that's what I've been doing. And I love it, you know, climbing around the world. I read a book called The Seven Summits by this guy named Dick Bass, and he made the Seven Summits famous. And I thought, how incredible to go around the world, every continent, experiencing these great adventures with a great team.
You ultimately, of course, managed to score this extraordinary success of scaling the summit of Mount Everest. That was back in 2001. And of course, in one of your previous books, we can hear all about that. Part of what is important for us to know in terms of your more recent adventure is something that somebody said to you as you were finishing your descent off of Mount Everest, words that you were not expecting this colleague to say to you, and words that really made a difference. Tell our listeners what was said to you and what kind of difference that made.
You come down from Everest, and, you know, people are like, oh, you shattered the world's expectations. And it's like, well, first of all, I shattered my own, because there wasn't 100% certainty that I was going to stand up there at 29,000 feet. You know, so many things came together, a great team and lots of preparation and weather. Came down the mountain and got down below it where it was the safer zone, and I knew I was going to live. And PV, our team leader, brought me aside, and he said, you know, don't make this the greatest thing you ever do. And I thought, yeah, that was really bad timing, because you're just really crushed physically and mentally. And I thought, no, let me go home and celebrate for the next 50 years. But what he was saying was, you know, these successes that we've all had, whatever they may be, you know, don't make them a funeral. Make them the launching point to more great adventure. You know, use that as a way to propel yourself towards new sort of surprising paths.
One of those that you ended up undertaking that proved to be an extraordinary experience was to return to Mount Everest with a group of blind Tibetans, young Tibetans, and taking, in a sense, then someone else on this amazing kind of journey. And it proved to be an incredible adventure, but also not easy in any way. And I so appreciate that you describe this expedition as honestly and frankly as you do, because as you say in the book, all of the complexity and difficulties really, in a sense, represented the way life so often can be, particularly for people who are faced with exceptional challenges.
Yeah, I'd gotten off this huge successful climb with Everest. You know, they called us one of the greatest teams that ever were on the mountain. And so I had this preconception now that all teams were like that. And I built this great team of Tibetan kids that were, they were shunned by their society. You know, people spit on them in the street. And I thought, let's do something where these, their villages, their families never would dream of, and let's help these kids get this really big bigness inside them, and it'll affect the trajectory of their lives. And it turns out that we struggled on that trip. You know, we had a film crew, we had the Tibetan kids, we had their teacher, Sabria, who was a beautiful lady from Germany who's blind, who ran the school, and she was worried about the kids. And we had Sherpas, who are the local people on Everest, and then, the, you know, they're descendants of the Tibetans, and but they're different, so everyone's fighting. And so I, off the heels of this amazing success, I have this team that's in absolute turmoil with cultural barriers and language barriers and age barriers. And ultimately, we wound up finding something meaningful, you know, which is something you have to do a lot of times in these more typical teams. You have to find the win and the meaning for everyone. But it took a lot to get there.
One of your best lines, I think, as you are describing all of this, is something to the effect that democracy does not work on the mountain. that it's often a situation in which you simply can't have committee meetings and long involved discussions to decide what's going to happen. So.
No, as the avalanche is pouring down the mountain, you don't have time to debate sometimes. So you elect a leader. You don't even elect a leader. You know, you just somebody has to be trusted to be that leader. And then you discuss, of course, as much as you can. But then that person has to weigh all the ideas and make a quick decision. And that's the safety of the mountains. You just have to have someone you trust. So, yeah, some trust broke down on that trip. And but ultimately, you know, the good news is that these kids in Tibet are some of the most educated kids in Tibet, and they're now sending money back to their families. It's hard to be shunned and be a pariah when you're the one sending the money home to your family. And so Sabria, the blind teacher who started that project, in a dozen years sort of changed the whole reality of what disability looked like in this entire country. And I brought that idea home with me because I thought, yeah, these barriers look intractable, and they're there for a reason, and they've been there for a thousand years, but you can break through these things in a dozen years. It's possible.
We're speaking with Eric Weihenmayer and talking about his newest book called No Barriers, A Blind Man's Journey to Kayak the Grand Canyon. Earlier in the book, he talks about the experience of going blind as a young teenager, but then of managing to reach the summit of Mount Everest in 2001, the first and still only blind person to achieve that, and his most recent real-life adventure to kayak the Grand Canyon, 277 miles of the rapids of the Colorado River. Until I read your book, I did not stop to really ever think about how different these accomplishments were. That is, climbing a mountain and riding the wild waters of the Colorado River through the Grand Canyon are two completely different adventures, both incredibly dangerous, but dangerous and difficult and challenging for a blind person in completely different ways. Just explain a couple of the most significant ways in which this was an adventure like none other you had ever experienced.
Well, my friend taught me how to do a roll. You get knocked over a lot of times on a kayak, and so you got to roll back up with your paddle and get yourself upright. And so it launched 6 years of training for the Grand Canyon. And, you know, at 40 years old, starting this new project, starting this new idea, like PV had said, you know, push forward into new terrain. And rivers were so utterly different, night and day from mountains. Mountains, you kind of have a little bit of control over your you know, your proximity. You know, you can stop and recollect, you know, collect yourself. Rivers, you can't do that. There's no brakes. And in fact, a lot of times you're not even fully in control. Yeah, you're sort of using the energy of the river to kind of get in position, but then there's no stopping. You just ride that energy at the river's pace and force. And it's like embracing chaos, like these, you know, forces that are so much bigger than you. And so I remember so many times along that journey just thinking, this is so hard starting over. At 40 years old, you just feel so vulnerable. Like, you know, Everest was supposed to teach me this great lesson and prepare me, and it didn't. I felt, you know, completely just laid out there.
Hmm. Well, I mean, one would come off of Mount Everest in a sense feeling invincible, and you felt anything but invincible in this experience. And what's really quite striking is even before you get to the Colorado River, it's a harrowing experience just in terms of the training. For instance, just say a brief word about the National Whitewater Center and the kind of things that you did there and how important it was for you to return there at one point to rebuild your own confidence that had been so completely dashed.
Well, the crazy part is that I work with at No Barriers with a lot of people who get stuck, you know. So, you know, when it gets really severe, people call it PTSD. And you get stuck in your brain. And so I went off on a river, and it was a huge flood stage, and I got over my head, and I got so scared. I could hardly get back in my kayak. I'd lost my confidence. I'd lost my combat role. And I realized I couldn't get through it, so I had to kind of back up and start over and reprogram my brain, repattern my brain. And so I went to this incredible center in Charlotte, North Carolina, where you can, it's a man-made river. It's a concrete river. And they actually pour water down it with pumps and then pump the water back up. And they have all these features underneath the water, these barriers and drop-offs that create the rapids. And so you can go over and over and over down these things and map out the rapid and really focus on your technique. And by doing that, I kind of rebuilt myself.
And in the midst of this adventure involving the Grand Canyon and the Colorado River, you also spend some time in the book talking about adopting a son from Nepal. I think it's a really intriguing and wonderful choice that you make to include that in the book as you do, even though on the surface it seems to have nothing to do with this latest undertaking. Tell us why it was so important to you to include this story in this book.
Well, I'm smiling right now because I'm so glad that you noticed that it wasn't random. You know, barriers are barriers, right? And we have different threads that run through our lives, and one of them is family. And when you get in your 40s, I have two beautiful kids. At the time, I had one beautiful kid, and we wanted to bring a boy home to bring into our family. And that adventure, those barriers were more complex than ever in a mountain or a river. It's just like the bureaucracy, when you read the book, it's like it's just the craziest thing in the world. Thank God I had my wife, who's very, very aggressive and can, you know, really think things through step by step, because we were in the middle of a civil war in Nepal, and adoptions had stopped, and so you're trying to like get to the right appointments, and you're walking through streets on fire, you know, burning tires, bricks on fire flying over your head, and you're like AK-47s pointed everywhere, and you're like, I need to get to my embassy appointment. You mind if I step around your AK-47? So it was a wild adventure bringing this guy home.
And it's a story, of course, that ultimately ends happily, as does your wild, dangerous ride down the Colorado River, which, of course, we can follow in your book. One of my favorite...
I hope I'm not giving away anything, but the blind guy lives.
Lives to tell about it. One of my favorite lines in the book is this: I'd grown up with defined rules of what a blind person could and could not do, and I knew what that blanket felt like as it lowered down and began to suffocate you. My whole life, I'd been trying to break free of it and do something bold and unexpected. You have certainly done that time and time again, and we read about it in your wonderful new book called No Barriers, A Blind Man's Journey to Kayak the Grand Canyon, published by Thomas Dunn Books. Eric Weyenmeyer, I thank you so much for joining me and for talking about your marvelous book. And if people want to explore something about your program called No Barriers, where can they find more information?
Yeah, go to nobarriersusa.org, and you can read about all our programs. We have one coming up this summer in Squaw Creek, California. We'll have 1,000 people all celebrating the ways they break through barriers in their life.
Wonderful. Eric Weinmeier, thank you again for joining me today on The Morning Show. This was fun.
Thank you.
It's 8:35, and you're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTDHD. And here's part two of today's program. And now I'm really pleased to be able to welcome to the Morning Show for this part of the program Dr. Ed Kawakami, who is one of my colleagues in the music faculty at Carthage, and a friend of his, Dr. Paul Luongo, who is going to be joining with him, collaborating with him in the next concert of the Carthage, I guess we call them the Carthage Philharmonic now, don't we?
We do indeed, yes.
I like the sound of that. A concert that's going to be happening at Carthage Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock in Siebert Chapel, free and open to the public. A concert that is going to include a world premiere and also include music by Jan Sibelius that is incidental music for Shakespeare's The Tempest, and there'll actually be a performance of The Tempest that will involve that music. We'll talk about that. And then there's also a really special project, and this is where Dr. Paul Luongo comes in, which involves some of the most famous and remarkable songs of Franz Schubert. And Dr. Luongo has undertaken some musical excavation or archaeology, if you will, and is going to be sharing some arrangements that really have not been heard in quite some time. So there are all kinds of exciting things that await you with Sunday afternoon's concert. So first of all, Dr. Ed Kawakami and Dr. Paul Luongo, we welcome both of you to The Morning Show.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having us.
Glad to have you here. Thanks for getting up bright and early. Dr. Kawakami, maybe you can explain why it is the two of you collaborating on this concert on Sunday. Explain your connection with Dr. Paul Luongo.
Sure. I believe we go back to 2009, is that?
I believe so, yeah.
We overlap for a year at graduate school, in graduate school at Florida State University. I was just starting my master's, and Paul was finishing his dissertation at Florida State.
And so you've wanted to collaborate on something ever since then?
Yeah, this was Paul's dissertational project, or part of it. And we heard a performance of it that year, at the end of that year, I think, spring of 2010,
yeah.
And I just fell in love with the works, and I've been wanting to do them since then.
So let's talk that I touched briefly on what we're talking about, namely some of the most noteworthy songs of Franz Schubert, but in some special arrangements that involve orchestra rather than the customary piano. So first of all, explain sort of the genesis of your exploration of this.
So I encountered these works in the archives of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra and the Newberry Library in Chicago. These are unpublished arrangements. And first off, Theodore Thomas, the arranger of these works, is the founding director of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. But he toured through America for about 30 years before that. And when he toured down to places like Savannah, Georgia, or other rural areas of America, he didn't just bring Beethoven 5. He didn't just bring the overture to Tannhäuser or something like that. He would bring these arrangements for solo voice and piano, or just piano, and intersperse them on the program. And I theorize that he did that to kind of ingratiate himself to American audiences that didn't have local orchestras. They hadn't ever heard Beethoven 5. They hadn't ever heard these symphonic works, but they all had pianos. They all had a lively domestic music scene, and they knew Earl King. They knew Der Doppelgänger. And so these solo works were actually more popular throughout much of America than many orchestral works. And So Thomas used these as practical pieces to reach out to American audiences that might have been unfamiliar with the other repertoire that he was bringing.
Wow. So in other words, he was taking repertoire intended to be solo voice and piano and orchestrating them.
Yes.
And this wasn't unprecedented, but it sounds like he did it to... A quite an exuberant extent.
He did, about 22. I mean, there are some other adaptations in various ways, but about 22 different arrangements. So I've got a forthcoming publication that picks 7 of the most popular of them, and of them, we're going to perform 3 of them this Sunday.
You said you came across these in the archives of the Chicago Symphony at the Newberry Library down in Chicago. How did you come across them? What were you looking for, or were you specific? Did you know of these, and were you searching them out?
I was looking into Theodore Thomas's 1902 performance of Bach's B minor Mass at the Cincinnati May Festival. The B minor Mass being a work that we might hear today with one or two people on a part, which was performed in 1902 with 800 singers and an orchestra of, I think, 124.
Oh, my.
And that fascinated me. We don't get a recording, but he made such meticulous notes to the score that it was, in a sense, a bit of a recording. So trying to reconstruct what this looked like. And then I stumbled across the arrangements and kind of tucked that in the back of my mind for maybe a later project.
Wow. As maybe some of our listeners know, the songs of Schubert have been orchestrated by lots of different people, including Brahms and Liszt and Reger and all kinds of other luminaries. How would you say the orchestrations, arrangements of Theodore Thomas stack up? I mean, they're already interesting just because they're so rare, they're unpublished. I mean, you're uncovering buried treasure here. How good are they? How well did he do at orchestrating them, would you say?
When looking through the 22 orchestrations, there are some works that show some signs of their age. They look much more like a late 19th century orchestration. That means a lot of doubling of different instruments, and it gets thicker than we're accustomed to with the way that we hear an orchestra today. It sounds like a 19th century arrangement. Sometimes it sounds a little bit like Sousa, which would makes sense. But I think Erl King is one of the best of them, and Der Doppelgänger and Amir absolutely as well. He was really adept at getting the orchestra out of the way and letting the voice do what the voice did. I think he had varying degrees of success with some of his arrangements, but some of them were absolutely spectacular. And it's worth noting a few of them he performed more than any other work he ever performed. So as much as he called attention to Beethoven 5 because he needed the American public to say that he was educating them, validating their sophistication, he actually had these other pieces that he slipped into the program that were far more important to keeping audiences in the seats. Schumann's Träumerei is the classic example of that. I think he performed that more than any other work in his career.
Wow. More than Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, for instance.
Right.
Wow.
As much as he brought attention to the other works.
Right. So these were crowd pleasers on his programs. So again, on Sunday afternoon's concert, the Carthage Philharmonic is going to be performing with Kyle Sackett, one of our voice teachers, which songs by Schubert?
Amir and Der Doppelgänger.
So those two.
As well as the orchestrated version of Erl King.
So Erl King, is that sung or just played?
This one is set for just the orchestra.
Just the orchestra. How interesting. Now, that I've not ever heard. I mean, I've heard orchestrations of it where it's actually sung, but not where it's only played. So how intriguing. Should be really, really fun. And are you going to be conducting?
I am. Dr. Kawakami has been gracious enough to let me have some wonderful time with his orchestra. It's been a fantastic experience. So I'll be up on the podium some, and he'll be up on the podium for The Tempest.
Mm-hmm. And we should also mention that Sunday afternoon's concert includes a world premiere. Tell us about that.
It does indeed. It sounds a little like a closed family, but it's also a world premiere by one of our colleagues, Dr. Mark Petering. He wrote it for us when I first joined the faculty 3 years ago, and I feel that we can really do it justice now, so we're giving it a whirl.
Wow. Can you describe what it's like?
Sure. It's a celebratory piece. It's really kinetic. It has a lot of motion to it. It's a blast, and there's no performance practice to it, so whatever we do, whether right or wrong, becomes the standard.
In other words, there's no precedent for it. It hasn't been
None
played before ever.
None at all. So it's it, there's a lot of that happening Sunday afternoon. It's a rather interesting process to not have some type of precedent to refer back to and say, oh, they did it this way. Oh, these must be the reasons why the performance practices is in place.
Wow. In addition to all that, as if all that didn't make Sunday afternoon exciting enough, then there is this matter of Shakespeare's The Tempest. Mm-hmm. So first of all, tell us just a little something about the play and then the music that the Carthage Philharmonic will be playing as part of this semi-staged performance.
Sure. The Tempest is one of the last last play that Shakespeare wrote. It's has the eponymic Tempest in it. The very first piece that the orchestra plays has been described as the longest onomatopoeia, ever. It's about 5 to 7 minutes of waves crashing and sails ripping and the ship breaking on the reefs and whatnot. Fantastic work. The Tempest, of course, is just like with any other Shakespeare play, is a very convoluted plot, and I'll refer everyone to Wikipedia rather than myself butchering the plot lines. But there's magic involved, and of course, little dramatic underpinnings where people are fighting against each other, and so on and so forth.
So we should maybe explain to our listeners that when we have incidental music, we're talking about music that, in a sense, is unnecessary. You can do a perfectly fine performance of The Tempest without a note of music being played, and that's typically what happens. But one choice one might make is to do such a performance with this additional music as a wonderful supplement. So how is it interspersed through the work? I mean, all the way through The Tempest, are we hearing sort of orchestral interjections?
Close. It's an abridged production of The Tempest. We didn't want to have the audience sitting there for 4 hours,
right,
and torturing them for 4 hours. as great as the music is and as great as the play is, it's abridged to about an hour, I'd say 45 minutes to an hour's worth. It's scenes are interspersed with music. I liken it to a movie. Movie scores really help enhance what's happening on the screen, what the actors are doing, and this is the same idea. We're hoping to enhance and set the stage, and in some sections we'll be underscoring what the actors are doing.
You must be so pleased with the exciting growth that has occurred with Carthage's orchestral program since you arrived.
It's unbelievable. My colleagues, yourself included, have been incredibly supportive of what we've been doing and what I've been doing. I couldn't have imagined a better place to have landed.
And say a quick word about something very exciting that you just did, I think, this past weekend.
Oh, yes. The Kenosha Unified School District Orchestra Festival. It's a gathering of all the orchestral programs in Kenosha. We gather for a weekend and perform it separately. So there's the cadets program, the middle schools and the high schools, and the two tiers of the high school orchestras perform separately, and then en masse. So at one point there were 1,300 school kids performing together, and it was incredibly inspiring to see the level of engagement and the quality of teaching and the quality of care that I saw throughout KUSD.
What was the climax of the concert with everybody playing?
It was Phantom of the Opera.
Oh.
Selections from. It was gloriously fun.
Right. Well, I'm sure Theodore Thomas would have approved of such a choice. So in the meantime, we want to remind people about Sunday afternoon's concert, 2 o'clock at Siebert Chapel, the Carthage Philharmonic, with a world premiere of Mark Petering's Introduction and Fanfare, these songs of Franz Schubert as arranged by Theodore Thomas, the founder of the CSO, recently uncovered and as yet unpublished works, and Dr. Paul Luongo will be conducting those. And there'll also be this abridged performance of Shakespeare's The Tempest with some of the incidental music of Jan Sibelius. So Dr. Ed Kawakami, Dr. Paul Luongo, thank you both for joining me for the morning show, and hope a lot of people will seek out what sounds like a fascinating and exciting concert on Sunday afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And here is just a little taste of that overture to The Tempest, incidental music of Jan Sibelius. And we're approaching 10 minutes before 9 o'clock on WGTD. To finish out the hour, I speak with Dr. Richard Horowitz, who's one of the country's leading authorities on Lyme disease, a rapidly spreading scourge that affects people all around the world, and a somewhat mysterious disorder. His new book is called How Can I Get Better? An Action Plan for Treating and Resistant Treating Lyme Disease and Chronic Disease, published by St. Martin's. I asked him to explain the origin of the name and why Lyme disease was named after Lyme, Connecticut, where a very serious outbreak of the disorder occurred in the 1970s. I then asked him to explain how Lyme disease is, in his words, a great imitator.
Right. So the problem with Lyme disease is that it can imitate a broad range of diseases. So, for example, people come to me with a diagnosis of chronic fatigue syndrome, which has been called many names. It's called myalgic encephalomyelitis, systemic exertional infection disease. In other words, these people have chronic fatigue, muscle and joint pain, memory and concentration problems. They can't fall asleep. And they're just basically told they have fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue. Many are diagnosed with autoimmune diseases like rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, multiple sclerosis. Lyme causes a broad range of psychiatric problems. So if you weren't depressed, you could all of a sudden become depressed, anxious. You can get obsessive-compulsive disorder, bipolar, schizophrenia, early dementia, sometimes mistaken for early Alzheimer's. So it imitates all these different diseases, and because the blood tests are not reliable, people come in and they say, you know, I have this chronic fatigue syndrome, I can't seem to get better, and then it turns out it's Lyme and overlapping factors that I discuss in my book.
I mentioned in the in my introduction how Lyme disease is spreading, and you certainly share some alarming statistics on sort of the scope of this disease. Give our listeners some sense of just how much Lyme disease is spreading, how rapidly, and maybe more importantly, why? What is behind the rapid spread of Lyme disease?
Right. So the CDC came out with new figures several years ago and said it was the epidemic was 10 times higher than we suspected. It was not 30,000, but over 300,000. And the recent figures are about 400,000. But you have to keep in mind that the blood tests for picking up Lyme will only pick it up in maybe about half the cases. So we're probably looking at over a million cases a year in the United States. And that's not counting all the other tick-borne diseases, because when you get bitten by a tick, it doesn't just contain Lyme disease. It also contains parasites like Babesia, which is like getting malaria at the same point. It contains Bartonella, which is a cat scratch fever type of bacteria. There are viruses in there. So you can get very, very ill from this. So the CDC revised the numbers, and then 2 years ago they said that there was a 320% increase in the number of counties affected, where it was spreading from Pennsylvania in all directions outward. And we now know that it has spread worldwide. I was called by the Chinese government years ago as a consultant to fly over to Beijing, and they told me privately 6% of the 1.4 billion people in China had Lyme disease. So we're talking millions and millions of people. It's a full-blown epidemic in Europe. People don't realize that this is one of the worst epidemics we've probably seen in a very long time, and only because the blood tests are unreliable, people don't realize how bad it is.
Wow. Well, the heart and soul of your book is where there is some hope. That is, you lay out some strategies for confronting Lyme disease and dealing with it and treating it. And the sort of the framework are seven central rules for dealing with Lyme disease. And the first one particularly intrigues me. You think we need to be making sure that it is the symptoms that drive both diagnosis and treatment.
Yes, I mean, the fact is that because we're not yet at a stage where the diagnostics are able to pick up Lyme, I developed a questionnaire. It was based on an older questionnaire by Dr. Boscano, and we, in fact, validated it just recently. We published it in the medical literature. We're waiting to hear back from the journal. But we validated the questionnaire in 1,600 people. So if someone is questioning and saying to themselves, well, I have fatigue, I have joint pain. The key to this disease is that the symptoms come and go. You have good and bad days. The joint pain, the muscle pain, and the nerve pain, which is often described as a tingling, numbness, burning, stabbing sensation, they migrate around the body, and it's one of the few diseases that does this. So if you have pain that's moving around your body without reason, and women are often worse right around their menstrual cycle, and then you take antibiotics for an unrelated illness and you say you feel better or worse, that usually suspects that you might have Lyme disease. So what I describe in the book with the symptoms, the reason we go through this is because the symptoms really do tell you where you need to focus. The first question on the questionnaire is sweats. Now, for example, around where you are, there are big cases of babesiosis, which is this malaria organism. The first question on the questionnaire is, do you have day sweats, night sweats, flushing, chills, air hunger where you can't catch your breath? Those are symptoms of babesia. So if someone fills out this questionnaire and I see symptoms of sweats in a young man, I say to them, well, I don't think you have menopause. You must have some other disease. So we go through the differential diagnosis. And then in my book, what I really go through in detail is that there are 16 reasons why people stay ill. And it's an analogy like someone who goes into a doctor's office with 16 nails in their foot saying they have foot pain. If you don't pull out all the nails, you're going to stay sick. And what we find is it's not just Lyme. It's other infections. It might be that people are not falling asleep. They might be eating the wrong foods that they're allergic to. They may have a problem with their blood pressure, which happens from the Lyme disease. The hormones are thrown off. Many of the doctors don't think about looking for these things. So really, if you have any form of a chronic fatiguing musculoskeletal illness and your memory's off, it's worth taking a look at the book, going through the questionnaire, and working with your physician to go through these 16 points to see whether you might in fact have something that's causing an inflammatory response in the body.
It's too bad that all cases of Lyme disease don't include that iconic bullseye-shaped rash that some people suffer from. If it was always there, then knowing that you have Lyme disease would be a simple matter indeed. But of course, as you rightly point out, it's much more complicated than that. You explore other matters, including lower inflammation. That is such an important key for so many sufferers of this. Say a quick word about the importance of detoxification, which is something that is important for the well-being of the body and something which is often compromised when someone suffers from Lyme disease.
Yeah, so, it's interesting that when people, for example, get memory and concentration problems, most of them think, well, I just need to put in an IV line and get IV medications like Rocephin. But the fact is that there are neurotoxins in the body, and what we've been finding looking at patients is that many patients now are showing up positive for mercury, for lead, for arsenic, for all kinds of heavy metals. About two-thirds of our patients are now showing up with mold toxins that are in the body. We're finding pesticides in some people, especially with Parkinson's disease. So we now know that there are 300 to 500 chemicals getting into people's bodies every day. Most of these are carcinogenic. They act as foreign-based estrogens. So when we detoxify the body, we find that about 70% of the people who have fatigue and joint pain and memory problems get better. So I describe in the book in detail the kind of detoxification therapies that we use. And in fact, even though I don't have Lyme disease myself, I take a lot of these type of supplements and things to open up the detox pathways because my whole family's had cancer, and I want to get these chemicals out of my body. So, in the title, when I talk about treating resistant Lyme and chronic disease, what I'm also referring to with the chronic disease is that even somebody healthy, if you read this book, you'll realize that infections and toxins are causing many people to be ill, and that's why I have a concern, by the way, with deregulating pollution controls, because I don't think people realize how much the pollution on top of the infections is making people ill, and detoxification is absolutely essential in a large number of the people coming to see me.
I appreciate how your book explores other matters, including that of not only restoring physical health, but also healing the emotional wounds. And our last minute or so, can you say a quick word about why that warrants the attention that you give it in your book?
There are some old studies on what's called psychoneuroimmunology, where there's a direct relationship between the mind and the body and how your immune system functions. And many of the people who've come to see us, they've been to 10 to 20 doctors. They're told it's all in their head. What I usually like to tell them is, well, what's really in your head is infections and toxins. And unfortunately, these people come in with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, or there's been issues of abuse early on. what we find is if we don't help people with the mind-body connection, that it's not just enough to take antibiotics or herbs or detox, you also have to deal with